Have you ever witnessed a disturbing event in public, an assault or someone being abused, but yet you felt it wasn't your place to intervene? But maybe you filmed it on your phone, then posted it online so that others could witness and express their outrage. This is the era of citizen journalism, but mobile technology has also expanded the so-called bystander effect, where people are in fact less likely to help a victim when others are present. Today, the reaction of the witness is to film rather than help. Now, that footage may be useful as evidence after the fact, but it doesn't help the victim or victims in the moment. And of course, it often becomes an internet meme, which is really just entertainment. Witness is a global organisation that's using the latest mobile technology to expose human rights abuses to a bigger and more immediate, and one hopes more active audience, whether it's over a racist rant on a Melbourne tram, or a police shooting in Chicago, or chemical weapons use in Syria. Sam Gregory is Program Director at Witness, where see it, film it, change it is the motto. Sam, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Witness was founded in 1992 by the musician and activist Peter Gabriel because he saw the public impact of the Rodney King video. This was where a local resident filmed the Los Angeles police bashing Rodney King, a black man, on the roadside. And of course, that ignited the Los Angeles riots. Was that really the start of the sort of video witness era?
I think it was a really pivotal moment because it was one of the first times that it really came into people's living rooms. This footage shot by someone who never meant to be filming that kind of footage. And like many of us who may end up being witnesses to human rights violations, George Holliday, who filmed that incredible piece of footage of Rodney King being struck more than 50 times, never planned on doing it. He did it with, you know, in that case, just the camera he'd bought for family events. I think it's a pivotal moment because even 25 years ago, you had this possibility of every one of us being a human rights defender. And of course, then not everyone had a camera. And now we've moved to sort of 25 years fast forward and billions of people have smartphones and potentially can be that type of human rights defender. But then they have exactly those questions that you raised, right? Of how do you do that well? How do you do that ethically? And how do you do it in a way that makes a difference? And that's the big challenge now.
Yes. Have they read about the bystander effect? Do you think they know about this bystander effect?
I think people are aware and often, you know, we see multiple people filming and some people are saying, wait, don't film, wait, do film. I think they're also often aware that there are limits to what you can do in the moment. So I think often people are making quite smart decisions to try and capture what they see and document and share it. They're not being cowardly in doing that. They're actually doing the right thing.
Often people don't intervene because they're fearful. They either fear becoming victims of violence or abuse themselves, or they think they might be subject to retribution later on. How can people like that be both helpful and protected in those situations?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to thinking about who's at risk in each of these situations. And typically, it's both the filmer and it's the person who is filmed, you know, the person who's being victimized. And some of this is just, you know, knowing how to make good decisions and having a heuristic in your mind about what could happen. And one way we often describe it when we're, you know, thinking of the simplest way to work with communities is to say, you know, imagine who you would least like to see this footage when it comes out. You know, is it the police commander? Is it the local military commander? Is it the local gang boss? Is it the local security chief for the mine? They're going to see it if it has an impact, right? They're going to see it. So bearing that in mind, you know, who do you need to protect? Do you need to make sure your identity is hidden? Do you need to not film the faces of the people who are involved? Do you not need to film them? And how do you get people to understand that who you might have filmed? And if you can't ask that, so sometimes in a crisis you can't, how do you make good decisions and use the tools available? And, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, simple rules of thumb like that, that you try and get into the hands of people, and then trying to make sure they have the tools to do that. And when you think of everyone as a potential human rights defender, you know, that's billions of people, that can't be hoping people will download a special human rights app onto their phone It has to be that when they open up YouTube or hopefully, you know, Facebook or Snapchat, they know how to blur a face when they do that. So they can both think through the logic of it, but then actually protect someone. And then sometimes there's going to be times where you shouldn't film, you know, because you're going to risk too much. So, you know, really trying to think, how do you give people the rule of thumb, but also the tools to implement that?
Yeah, there's a huge range of incidents that people do film. You've got the racist rant, and that's happened a lot in Australia on public transport. And then you've got mass violence. But let's look at this recent example of a passenger who was dragged off the United Airlines flight. This is after the United Airlines had messed up his seat booking. Someone filmed it, but if you look at that footage, hardly anyone on that plane said or did anything to intervene. I'm just wondering if the mobile phone has given us a great excuse to be a bystander because, you know, hey, look, I did film it.
Yeah, I think there's the potential that we can default to that. And there's a really good question on that footage from the plane there of, did we need 30 different accounts of it? And a really important question that we grapple with is when in all these encounters, you know, there is often a victim as well as a perpetrator. And the question that would come up for us is, think about what is ethical sharing of the footage of a violation. So do you need to show the victim's face? Do you need to re-expose them to that victimization? And we made an argument publicly after the United event that people should have blurred the victim's face. And it's something that we've worked on a lot, is getting platforms like YouTube to build functions to allow people to blur right into the platform so that people can make good decisions about, you know, how we expose victims and survivors to re-victimization. So I think, yes, we should be encouraging people to think, do we need another video of something? And then if they do share the video, are they sharing in a way that makes a difference? The flip side of that, and this is, you know, not in the United case, but, you know, one of the key pieces of advice that we've seen in police violence in the US is actually don't share the video straight away. One of the things that made the biggest difference in one of the few cases in the US that's gone to a trial was the shooting of Walter Scott, who was a man who was shot 7 times in a police encounter. And what was interesting in that case is that the eyewitness who filmed it didn't release it straight away. They waited for the police account to come out, in which the police officer came up with a story about an altercation that didn't happen as it did. And then he released the footage. And that goes contrary to how we think about, you know, our social media world, where it's like, can we get it up instantly? It's often what people think about. And that may be the best piece of advice in the US context you can give someone who's a witness to, say, police violence, is wait for the official story to come out so that you can then challenge it. Don't let your story come out and then be challenged by the greater authority of the police and a story that they can concoct to challenge it themselves.
The complication, as you point out, in releasing something immediately is that what you risk becoming seen as being part of an organized or sort of orchestrated campaign, whereas in the Walter Scott case, we actually had someone providing pretty definitive evidence, but he clearly wasn't part of an orchestrated campaign.
Yeah, I think the key distinguishing factor there is, you know, in well-functioning justice systems, we should trust the police accounts, right? Mm. You know, we hope that our police are effective. So we put greater faith in police accounts. And typically when people release the footage, it could come from an organized group. And we've done a lot of work with, you know, cop watching groups who are, you know, very organized groups who monitor police activity in the US and in a number of other countries. And I think they do it ethically and I think they do it well. So I don't know if it's necessarily whether it comes from an organized entity, because often those organized entities also are able to think what is important to share, not just let's just throw out any piece of media into the ecosystem, into the internet. It is really about who gets to tell the story first and how that gets challenged in the system.
It's Andrew West, and this is Sunday Extra in for Tom Switzer. My guest, Sam Gregory. He's the program director at Witness, which is a program designed to bring video testimony to some very tragic events around the world. Sam, what are the rules around, quite frankly, filming death? Because you raised this in a paper that you wrote, because there can be a very mawkish effect. And you warn against that. You also warn against this sort of over-sentimentalizing where people feel almost satisfied because they say, oh, this made me cry.
Yeah, I think it's something we've been grappling with throughout our work, is that there's first the graphic imagery. Is we know that people will turn away if they're exposed to too much decontextualized graphic imagery. And a lot of our work, which isn't at the eyewitness level, because we work at a lot of different levels, we also work with people who try and curate and make sense of all this eyewitness footage. And a lot of that emphasis there is on how do you give context to the footage? So don't just share endless graphic violence. Try and explain to people why you're showing it, contextualize it as, you know, a war crime or a human rights violation, contextualize it next to other types of footage. So I think part of it is how do we help, particularly for people who are working in a long-term way as rights activists with communities, share that footage in a way that makes a difference. A great example of that is work we did with LGBTQ activists in the US who are working with this horrible footage that's shot by people who witness assaults on transgender people in the US and gender non-conforming people. And they shoot this footage to celebrate the assaults. People are shouting and yelling and celebrating as they film. Now, you could reshare that and that would just perpetuate the damage to the individuals in the community. But what we did with allies was say, let's turn this around and show how this actually shows the pattern of violence, shows this problem that has been hidden. So I think one thing is it falls upon, you know, human rights groups and activists to really contextualize the graphic footage.
We have to wind up in a moment. There's a very big sort of mobilizing effect here, though, and I want to end by asking you this. Live streaming is obviously the most immediate way to bring a large audience. There could be thousands of people who are watching on their laptops or their phones. How do you bring that large audience, though, into the moment?
So that's been the focus of a lot of our work recently, isn't it? And it goes back to that question you said about we don't want people just to be, you know, spectators and voyeurs or digital bystanders. You know, live streaming has this tremendous potential to bring people into the moment, to have them standing with people and to take actions that directly impact in the moment. And we've been experimenting a lot with that. We have a project called Mobilize Us that has been working with activists on the front lines of facing police violence in Brazil. And what we've been experimenting with there is not actually trying to bring millions of people into a live stream. We said, instead, let's get the right people into the live stream. So let's try and bring the people who live in Rio City Center into those live streams and then ask them to take actions in the moment that really make a difference. So, you know, calling the police station right when a protest is being suppressed, or if they have legal skills, actually helping provide guidance around what people should be filming. So we're trying to take the idea of the live stream and the fact that it's happening right now, but step away from this idea that it's just another way to watch someone else's misery, because we'll fall into the same traps as before of kind of being digital voyeurs. So that's a big focus of us is to make live stream into a powerful tool.
Yeah. So how do you do that? How do you make live stream such a powerful tool?
There's a technical part and there's a storytelling part. The storytelling part is don't just drop people into crisis. In the same way that just showing someone a graphic image from a situation will probably alienate them, we've really been thinking about, you know, how do you introduce people to the community of activists? How do you show them what it's like to live in the favela? How do you show them the celebrations, you know, the Children's Day when people are on the bouncy castle, as well as the protest, as well as the public hearing where they're asking people to take action, as well as the aftermath of a shooting, so that you build a relationship, so that this is a relationship of being with people, not just watching their crisis. So that's the storytelling side. The action side is you want to bring people in and ask them to do something that matters. So, you know, if you're a lawyer or you know how to translate from Portuguese into English, I want to bring you in and say, help do this so that we can make this more accessible to more people, or so that you can provide legal guidance that isn't present on the ground. Or alternatively, it could be, how do we bring in a group of people and use their presence in a very powerful way? So we've been experimenting with showing the number of people watching on site as a way potentially to deter violence or at least emphasize that there are watching eyes. So again, really trying to think about how you use the audience in very concrete, tangible ways that matter to the frontline communities and the activists, but also draw on what the viewers can do in the moment.
Well, Sam, there'll be a lot of our audience that will be very energized, I think, by what you've said. Sam Gregory, Program Director at Witness. He also teaches human rights and participatory media at Harvard's Kennedy School. Sam, thanks for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks for having me on the show.